All right, everyone, here we are, episode 26 of Christian History and Ideas. I'm John Coleman, and joined today by Dr. Nirmal Das. How are you doing, Dr. Das?
Fine, thank you, John. Great to be here. Good to see you.
Yes, you too, for sure. So we are continuing our discussion. This is episode 4 of our latest series, appraising modernity, appraising where we are as citizens of the world and also citizens of the kingdom of heaven, if you like. So we're looking at the church in relation to the world, where things are going, both in ways secular and profane. And we're going to continue an analysis chiefly in this episode of the state of things. And then at the end, we will turn our discussion to various options of where things are going forward. They cannot continue as they are. And indeed, the events show that certain arguments and loggerheads and so forth are quite literally irrelevant at this point. Before we do that, we have two selections here from Holy Writ. And the first is from Romans. And remind me, Dr. Das, Romans chapter 8. And what are the verses 5 through 10?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
For those who live according to the flesh are concerned with things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit with things of the Spirit. The concern of the flesh is death, but the concern of the Spirit is life and peace. For the concern of the flesh is hostility towards God. It does not submit to the law of God, nor can it. And those who are in the flesh cannot please God. But you are not in the flesh. On the contrary, you are in the Spirit, if only the Spirit of God dwells in you. Whoever does not have the Spirit of Christ does not belong to him. But if Christ is in you, although the body is dead because of sin, the Spirit is alive because of righteousness. And our second selection is from St. Matthew, chapter 27, verses 3 through 6. Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that Jesus had been condemned, deeply regretted what he had done. He returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, "I have sinned in betraying innocent blood." They said, "What is that to us? Look to it yourself." Flinging the money into the temple, he departed and went off and hanged himself. The chief priests gathered up the money and said, "It is not lawful to deposit this in the temple treasury, for it is the price of blood." Tu autem domine miserere nobis. All right, we have some great words there, and a great whetstone to carry on our conversation. So we have met the enemy, Dr. Das, and he is us. Let's take it from there.
Exactly. And when we talk about the enemy, when we talk about, globalists and all this sort of thing, you know, these great forces that oppress us, we have to keep always this point in mind, is that who gives them the legitimacy to do this, to do the oppression, to do all of this sort of thing to us? And I think this is a point that often is missed by people, because we are always in the rationalist, materialist, secular mindset, which is we always look to another, to the other, as they say, in certain parts of literary criticism. When you're always looking to the other to blame, to do something with, to be the foil, to react against, you are therefore participating in the entire cycle or circle. You are legitimizing that other that you're trying to say is oppressing us, etc. We have all this, these entities that exist to solely oppress the innocent us, like the deep state and all this sort of thing that we, all these things you hear about. But We then dutifully pay our taxes, do everything we're told, et cetera, et cetera. We play by all the rules that legitimize these forces of oppression upon us, i.e. we keep giving them power. And this is not simply, you know, the X in the ballot box. This is giving power in all kinds of ways. We legitimize our oppressors continually, which then means to me that we are always agreeing to the oppression and therefore agreeing to the power and the legitimacy of these various entities. And this is the dynamic of the world, I guess, in a nutshell, is that we have to, exist within certain kinds of structures for sure, but are we going to allow certain other people to dominate the structures, which then, of course, turn into modes of oppression? And if we keep doing this again and again, and then complaining and whining about it, in videos and in articles or even in books and all that sort of thing. And this is, you know, by the way, a footnote, this is what I've always noticed about these kinds of discussions for, you know, majority of them, is that they're great at describing how oppressed everyone is. Oh, look what they did now. Oh, look what happened today. But when it comes to, okay, what do I do about it? Suddenly you have very, very childish responses. You have childish, even non-existent responses, i.e. there's nothing to be done. The best thing you can do is complain about how oppressed you are, which then makes the whole system of that structure legitimate. We agree to be oppressed. We agree to be the slaves. We agree to do this or that. And by doing so, we legitimize those that order us around. And this, by the way, is not a Christian way of living, as we just looked at in our passage from Romans and that passage you read about Judas's, returning of the silver, the 30 pieces of silver. What that says to me, those two, passages from Scripture, what those two say to me is that there is another way of living than simply legitimizing state authority or legitimizing those things that exist. Yes, we enter into them sometimes in various ways, but we have to keep always, the ultimate goal before us. And that is not become totally fleshly. This is the tragedy and the sin of Judas. It's purely fleshly. He betrays Christ because Christ will not become the Jewish king. And that's the problem. And Paul, in that passage in the Romans, is saying to us that we have to maintain our complete humanity. Humanity is not simply flesh. Humanity is something more than flesh. And as long as we keep this idea of the complete humanity in mind, we will not often be led astray. But unfortunately, given the strength of rationalism and materialism in our world, and the methods we use to explain the world now, which are exactly the kinds of methods that we complain about, we are always misled and fall into confusion. Yes, we want to be faithful Christians, but this is the problem. And that but, of course, leads us into all kinds of problematic areas, where God can be she, et cetera. I mean, I won't elaborate on all of these things. Everyone knows about them. The essential thing here, I think I would suggest, is that we do not misread what humanity is all about and our own humanity. And we often do. We misread ourselves, and then we project that misreading onto the world, and the world then becomes more confused, perpetually more confused, because we add our confusion to the mix. And this, of course, leads to all kinds of problems. And this is the real problem of our age. And of course, this is the real problem of the church, because it no longer understands that passage, I think, in Romans. It no longer knows what that is. It wants to be fleshly. And because it wants to be fleshly, and, you know, going along to get along and, you know, et cetera, it falls into confusion itself. And so you have not only mixed messages coming from the church, but no messages coming from the church. It's, you know, anything goes, messages coming from the church, et cetera. And this leads to, of course, empowerment of those that ultimately are out to destroy us. And by, you know, we can name them in various ways, but the power is the same, which is total de-Christianization of the world. That's what we're really looking at. And so far, it has been wildly, as I said, successful, because we've basically have painted ourselves into a very small corner and from which we are having all kinds of problems coming out of.
Yes, 3 points, I think, of on that regard. We all have little bailiwicks and areas of interest if we're in this, knowledge world or research world or whatever. I don't even know what you call this stuff anymore, which is part of the problem or not. But I tend to be quite interested in the legal system. And one of the motifs we use in that is... well, not the shadow man so much as the vampire. And on the principle of not actual vampires being about, although there is something of that, which would be a whole show on its own, different cell lines and whatnot. But there is a principle in old Abraham Stoker's book about letting the beast or the enemy cross into your domain, your house, right? He's if you've ever read that great Victorian book, the vampire cannot enter into your house by force. He has to be let in through a window, or at the door. He's, you know, a dapper, this fellow here isn't too dapper looking, but he has to be let in through the entryway in any case. In the book, he's quite a bit more charming, but nevertheless, the principle stands, right? He has to cross the threshold in there. There's a sort of principle there. Isn't that one of the old definitions of sin? It has to be willful. You have to allow it, right? You have to consent by the will. This is interestingly, just in terms of moral theology, why someone could not physically do anything and yet commit a sexual sin, and yet another person could be raped and still be a virgin. So, because it's a matter of the will, it's not primarily a matter of the body. And you can apply that to all other sorts of actions and whatnot. So that was one thing I thought to rejoin, this idea that this system on 1,000 different ways is one which invites us to contract with it. And then the second point I'd like to bring up is a point of empathy. And towards that, I'll get rid of Mr. Dracula there and Mr. Shadow Man, and we'll go back to the full screen. The second point is empathy. And in this No BS year, as we come to the reality that the Catholic world is as sectarian as the Protestant world, formally and informally, we must perhaps have a certain, you know, Dr. Doss talks about asking the powers that be to be Christian. I can think of in Connecticut a very noble group of people that repeatedly for the past couple of years have been making convoys to Hartford in order to ask the archons in Hartford permissions, you know, not to get vaccines or not to have assisted suicide. And in the interest of empathy in the order that's rising, we who have so pilloried Protestants and so forth may find ourselves having sympathy with various Christians outside of the church, such as the Amish or all sorts. And let us use this time for a type of real sympathy and real empathy and real regard for groups that have not in you know, certain ways like this lot, By the way, these Amish are less cute when your car is behind them. Let me tell you, we have a bunch of these over in, across the border in New York. It's not so charming when you're driving around. But nevertheless, we will find as things continue to develop as they are, that these groups we saw as enemies, perhaps, or as competitor, that we will find ourselves having more sympathy, and perhaps they were right all along. I don't say how far we push that, but there is that. So that's the second point I wanted to bring up. And then the third point, just about asking permission from the ruling order, as it becomes increasingly hostile, and ultimately this will lead to, and is in present tense, leading to persecution. I'm reminded of the verse from 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses about 1 through 4, where Paul stands agape. He stands agape at the Christians who were going to the legal courts in his day to iron out their disagreements and their fights, right? And you can go read that selection, but he can't believe that the worshipers of God would go into these courts to settle their disagreements. And it's the same thing. So I can't give anyone a hard time for, you know, trying to go through the political channels, but I think increasingly they have no tolerance for things. They're not even eventually going to even hear you out in the hearings and whatever. We can see that with the hate crimes laws. We can see, you'll see it. You'll see the Bible. You're going to have to edit out parts of the Bible, or they're not going to run it on Amazon. You know where this is going. And the fourth point, if not to gainsay Dr. Doss in any fashion, but just to realize the gravity of the order that's rising, I would intimate that actually, ultimately, it's an anti-logos or anti-Christ system that's rising. But you can see that going against other groups as well, mind you. On the natural order, shall we say, you can see what's happening to the Indian farmers. It's a microcosm example with the farmers over there. But you can see people who are more connected to reality just in their day-to-day living. They're not plugged in despite all those computers or whatever they put up in the slums to you know, those free computers, those kind of weird social experiments that they've been running. But and all the UBI and all the digital currency and all the experiments out there. But also, as of this recording, the order is going hard. It has been, I suppose, for at least a century, but it's been cranked up lately in the Islamic world. You can see the same game they pulled in the so-called white countries 100 years ago with contraception. They're doing the same thing now in Egypt. That's a big thing right now. The Quran's not against contraception. And they have their arguments, right? They pay off the Islamic imams and whatever they pay. And you can see it. They're pulling the Quran out of the schools right now in Egypt. And it's all to fight extremism, right? So you can see you're right on the point of it's an anti-Christ agenda, but you can see it has other fronts as well, because this order is against anything that isn't it.
I agree. I completely agree. It's the established, it's the old, what happened in the French Revolution. Exactly the same sort of thing is going on here. Because what did the French Revolution end up doing? It ended up wanting to implement and enforce a new cult, a new religion, and with the cult of reason, of course. So, famous churches like the Notre Dame of Paris became temples of reason. They stripped the churches down, totally removed any kind of Christian reference in them, and erected statues of reason and so forth. And that's where, people went to have reasonable discussions over coffee and all that. Coffee was popular in the 18th century. This establishment of the cult.
Still popular, mind you.
It is, yeah. So this establishment of cult, of a new cult, is the ultimate goal. So yes, it is de-Christianization, but it's also, the incomplete abandonment of any notion of God in any other context as well. So of course, Islam is also going to be a fitting target for that approach. Yes, the new man.
This is the new man, but just so the audience knows, this is a reconstruction of the death mask of Robespierre.
Oh, okay. Oh, I very good. Interesting. So that was a good connection with the new man. He's the architect of all of that. Yes, I didn't know that. Thanks for showing that. Thank you. I guess that's Robespierre without the gunshot in his face, in his mouth, because they shot him in the mouth first. But anyway, that's getting gruesome. It's the establishment of the cult, and it's the age-old dream of creating the new man, creating a new human being who is going to be better than the old human being. And notice, this is what the transgender movement is all about. The transgender movement is all about improving the human body and allowing more choice for the human body. And of course, choice means you can be whatever you like. So this is the new man. This is the new cult. And the cult, therefore, only can succeed when the church becomes the temple of X, Y, or Z, temple of reason or temple of secularism or temple of progress. That's when the cult, the new cult, succeeds. And that's when the new man can properly be born. The new man cannot be born through the midwife of the church. The church cannot be the midwife of the new man ever. And this was established by the revolution once and for all. That was what this is all about. But the church could only be, the new man could only be born through a new midwife, through a new process, which was one of complete materialism and complete reason. Midwifery is going to be the issue here as well. So who will bring to birth the new man? Notice the deep, deep theology here. And this is the sad part of all of this as well. Notice this too elaboration of the Annunciation, of the birth of Christ, and all of that sort of thing. The birth of the new man is the new Messiah. So that notion of the transgendered human being, well, this is the new Messiah of the cult. The transgender identity, the transgender creature, is the new Messiah of this cult. So all of these categories, all of these structures are not just dreamt up by crazy academics, though they're just handmaidens of that. But this is actually a very sinister, demonic, satanic subversion of Christ. This is what we're looking at. Perpetually, it's a subversion of Christ. When we talk about, say, Islam and all that sort of thing, people often have just simple gut reactions to it, but we also have to keep in mind that Islam also has a very particular Christology. In fact, as we've discussed lots of times, or mentioned, I should say, Islam is, a heresy of Christianity. But, that's a topic we can get to some other time. So what we're really then ultimately looking at is this perpetual pursuit of building, creating, giving birth to the new Messiah, the new man, the transgender, transhumanist creature who is going to save mankind, save the world, save the planet, save the earth, save the climate. Notice the theology here. And it's always a subversion. It's always a flipped over theology, the truth of theology, which is Christ. So it's always a flipping of Christ into it's something opposite. So you take Christ and you flip him into the transgender. That's what this is all about. And I mentioned in our last episode that Jesuit priest who says it's okay to call God she, that again is the exact same thing. It's this flipping of theology into its opposite, into its demonic version. And that demonic, satanic version is the problem, right? And this is, you know, this is the other aspect. This is the faith aspect that we're dealing with, exactly. Once we understand this, once we understand that we're really dealing with a recasting of Christianity into its demonic form, i.e. Christ now becomes the transgender, transhumanist creature, and it needs to be given birth through a proper channels. It has its annunciation. It has its, you know, its Christmas story. It's going to have its passion story, which is perpetual. It's called xenophobia, transphobia, and all of this sort of thing, the persecution. And then, of course, it's going to have its redemptive salvation, resurrection story, where it's going to triumph. So these forces that we're encountering are, first of all, nothing new, of course, but we also have to recognize, and by this I mean all people of faith, and especially the baptized. I want to use this term so we don't get confused with, you know, Catholic, non-Catholic, and all that sort of thing. But the baptized, those that believe in Jesus as God, we have to recognize that something sinister also is going on here, something profoundly sinister. Why? Because it is the replacement of Jesus by a transhumanist creature as the Messiah. So, and this transgender movement is simply the birth story of that greater creature that is going to be coming around later on. And this creature, the transhumanist, of course, is the machine man, run by a machine, you know, et cetera, et cetera. People know about this all the time, so we won't elaborate. But there's a theology here, and we must keep in mind this theology lest we become tainted by it and destroyed by it. Because I see in churches a lot of receptivity for this idea. Oh, they're just humans too, transgenders. Oh, you know, they're human too. That line is always used. But the point is, no, they're not human anymore. Sure, God made them human, but they gave up, they abandoned their humanity in order to become the flipped version of the Christian message, of Christian salvific process, of Christian theology. So that's where I see all of this. So there's the sinister dark side of this, you know. And of course, the mastermind in all of this, of course, is the old enemy, Satan.
Yes, and of course the powers that are bringing up this latest gender dysphoria topic, they of course don't actually care at all about those people. It's just another another tool. 100 years ago, that same agenda, as I see it, used the churches. And then the churches were convenient for a while, and they've been, you know, more or less put out to pasture, something I'd like to elaborate in our last stretch here. And then various other groups are useful for a while, but they're cast aside. In fact, there are certain sorts from that world or that commentary world identify as transsexual and I suppose they have more integrity than a lot of people because they're actually physically manifesting the chaos inside, which is, I suppose, more to their credit than most people in the West who are just, like a lot of conservatives, just complaining but doing nothing about it. There's a certain giving of the due there, if I may be allowed. I used to go on about the birth certificate to people and about the legal system, and I don't even waste my time anymore because nobody, even if they agree, they don't do anything about it. So what's the point? May your chains sit lightly. Anyhow, one of the individuals who has a presence online, transsexual, cross-dresser, whatever, they pointed this out, actually, that about this idea of the bathrooms, which the media runs every couple of years, right? They pointed this out. We never had a problem. We had whatever bathroom we wanted or we needed to go into. No one ever gave us a hard time, right? This is used. These people are a tool, just like certain so-called racial, so-called minorities are a tool. The Islamists are a tool for this, or I mean, they just change them as like ratchet heads. It's just a ratchet. Yeah, and you watch the baptized. We'll give it a couple of years. They'll be next in the carousel to be the next agenda, and then they'll go back towards the feminists, and then they'll switch out the ratchet head for the Islam and just rinse and repeat. But the whole time is the agenda's moving.
It's the creation of the new man. This is exactly the agenda. Is the creation of the new man exactly? Which is the flip, flip side of the Christian man, of the Christian human being, or, you know, to extend it further to a person of faith, if you want to be neutral about it. Yes, exactly. And that is the greater, it's the old Robespierre's dream, the new man, the new cult. It's a structure of all revolutions. And this is why all revolutions are violent. No matter what, they are always about violence. Why? Because they all want to create the new man. This is my critique of all those conservatives, whatever adjective we want to use, who routinely, get on the internet and all that, and they complain about the globalists, et cetera, et cetera. And this is my critique is that once you start, sure, you have a legitimate beef against something. Sure, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. But once we get into critiquing what is going on, we continually offer them legitimacy. We always allow them access to our power, our own power, our individual power that we have. And once we do that, once we allow them access, like you said, vampire-like, once we allow them, then they are always stronger than us, because our critique is nothing more than grumbling, because we have never, properly processed our critique beyond complaints. We haven't theologized at all what it means to be human anymore. And this is, this can segue us into our next part. And this is the grand, great failure of the church, that it no longer understands how to theologize the mind. And one had hoped that since, the church still possesses the schooling system, one had hoped that they would use it for that purpose, but of course they don't. They secularize just as much as anybody else. So we don't know how to create that proper mindset that will allow the grumbling and the complaining and the whining to become something as a serious challenge to the construction of the new man. We all want to be the new man, that's all. Whether we will end up wearing dresses and putting lipstick on is just a matter of choice now. But we've all become emasculated. We've all become, what's the opposite of, how do women become non-women? Well, when women become non-women, I can't think of the word. So men have become non-men and women have become non-women. We agree to this, It began for, I hate to be, particular about it in this regard, but that began with this legitimizing of homosexuality. And then, of course, it became segued into transgenderism. It was all a process of creating the new man, of, delegitimizing the proper function of humanity and then introducing a better version of it. And this has its manifestations in all aspects of life, unfortunately. This is how we all operate. This is what we always say, the old is bad, the good is new. This is our mentality in all kinds of ways. So unfortunately, the church doesn't know how to legitimize itself anymore. This is my big complaint about the church. This is where, my biggest complaint and I guess critique of the church is that it shows no legitimacy. It can only kind of, I hate to be mean, but all it can do is create, quote, Bible verses, and these are fossils then, if that is all that is. Even St. Paul, I can't remember the reference offhand, even St. Paul says, get over this stuff and move on, So yes, there's great liturgical value and spiritual value in scripture. But unfortunately, when we try to flip scripture over into legitimizing society, we fail miserably. It becomes a joke. People laugh at it. And we're embarrassed about it. We're embarrassed about introducing scripture into society. Why? Because we've accepted the fact that this is something somehow embarrassing. Because embarrassment, of course, is a personal reaction, which means that we actually believe that this is embarrassing. There's no real place of scripture in society. We actually believe it. These are the problems, and these are very real problems of legitimacy. So this means then that the church, too, has accepted the new man and is awaiting its birth. And this is the sinister part of it, and this is why, in our previous discussion, we looked at Luke 18:8, where Christ, and I find that a very harrowing verse, actually, where the faith itself is no longer to be found on earth when Christ returns. And this, I think, is something we as the baptized need to seriously, seriously consider and think about, because if we are embarrassed by our faith in the public square, and I don't mean this simply as a form of a test or anything, then that means we've accepted our defeat. That's what I find to be the saddest part of all of this sort of thing, that Christians are in fact embarrassed about their faith in the public sphere and do all kinds of things to hide it or mute it or explain it away as somehow inconvenient or something incompatible with the cult that is being established. So notice the church is always blamed for this or that. The church is always blamed, because you're a Christian, so that's why you do this. Or the church is that way because it's old or ancient, etc., etc. This is all the same sort of mentality. We too have accepted the new man, that is being constructed, and we unfortunately, sadly, await his arrival.
As we turn in our last stretch here, Dr. Das, having set that up in a fine way, I'm struck with the belief myself that a lot of these headaches heretofore, as this order rises in its sternness and its humorlessness and its slavery, this technocracy or whatever we call this, this new order that's rising, so you have the Christian world in whatever sect making a fool of itself endlessly. I don't know if it's so much that people are embarrassed about their faith as that they are embarrassing themselves and don't take themselves seriously. But we can hash out in another time, perhaps. The distinction is not important for this point as we bring things, at least for this episode, to a close in the next 10 minutes or so. It would appear to me, and I'd like you to respond to this, that the Protestant sects in their organized aspect are and have been for the last century non-existent. There is no movement, no organized Protestantism. What remains amongst the best of them is a type of low church evangelicalism, a type of Brother Billy in the storefront church sort of thing, with having the fumes and some heresy, some doctrines, knocking around there. And there's a few, 9-point Calvinists out there once in a blue moon. But I mean, it's a dead thing. You have an amputation, a separation that's existed, but as a movement, it's burned itself out and largely has gone the way of the world. Okay, and then that what remains is a shadow of its former self intellectually and organizationally, but very sincere it seems to be. Okay, grand. So it would seem a lot of the doctrinal problems have either become irrelevant to most people, or what remains in the institutional structure actually has been formally ironed out. For instance, Catholics and Lutherans at this point have no disagreement on the doctrine of grace, and haven't for the past 30 years. That might come as a shock, but you know, that's the reality. You can look at the concords and things from the 1990s towards that end. But yeah, so Protestantism has been dead probably for 200 years, really, if you want to, where you put your goalpost. And then it would have seemed that the Catholicism, as it exists presently, itself is now on a type of Battle of Manila Bay death ride, Charge of the Light Brigade death ride, a Kronstadt death ride, use whatever late 19th century, early 20th century analogy of, you know, it clearly doesn't, after COVID-19, the Catholic Church structurally doesn't seem to even want to exist. Much like the French Constitutional Church, it thinks it's really gotten a good deal by cutting all these resettlement agreements. So at least in this country of America, the bishops are basically just immigrant resettlement agents. And that's it. I don't care what you or I think the Catholic Church is. That's what it does right now. And that's how it is. So that's either it's going to, you know, just go the way of the Protestant sects and become completely irrelevant, or probably there will be a physical force, persecution. And we can do 100 examples of the present secular order. It's not even going to humor the churches for much longer. You have many noble pastors and whatnot up there keeping the churches open. We see how the state regards that as if it is a little microcosm. And I think I've made my point for you to respond to here, Dr. Dawson, our closing minutes. Down here, we had, Franklin Graham Samaritan Purse at the beginning of COVID-19. And they opened up a hospital, I think Central Park. Right. And then the social justice saviors showed up, and they're homophobes. And not only were they booted out at a point where people believed there was a real crisis back in March and April, where that was the perception, they were trying to meet it to their credit, the Samaritan's Purse. Not only did the town of New York, the city of New York, run them out the second the mob got on them, but they charged Samaritan's Purse rent for the time they opened their free hospital. Okay, so that's a vignette. You have your vignettes up there. Do you see that? What do you think about a coming persecution? What do you see as basically the Reformation and all the inter-Catholic stuff basically becoming irrelevant very, very soon, truly irrelevant? They're not going to be there. These people, the problems are also therefore going to solve themselves, much like the Revolutionary Constitutional Church. That was solved by the revolutionaries because they just killed all those people. And then you kept it moving, and you had a very different ecclesiology in France in the 19th century.
I think you've hit it on the head. What we're moving towards is the new church, and it's going to be not part of these older structures.
We're not using that term in the sense that certain figures like Bishop Williamson or whatnot use that term, the new. We're not saying that in a critical way, but this this is the reality. There will be a new ecclesiology, just like after the ancient period, you enter the medieval period. That's a very different structure you're looking at.
Exactly. I think that's the point we should actually stress, that transition from the early centuries of the church into the Middle Ages. This is what we're really looking at. A drastic change as that, actually. So by the new church, you're right. We're not referring to any of that. But this change over is going to be profound. And I think it will be triggered by more persecution. I think we're going to be entering into a new age of martyrdom in various ways. And this martyrdom doesn't really require simply, you know, being killed, but in other ways, silenced, et cetera, et cetera. That too is part of that process. And I think why this is, and we've talked about it very, you know, previously, why this is because the church in its true sense, the church as Christ, the Church of Christ, the church in its true sense is the only legitimate power that stands and opposes the new order or the new man. And this is why this is the grand enemy. So I think COVID was the first onslaught of what is coming next. I hate to be sinister about it, but I think COVID did a fine job of destroying buildings that we call churches. They have become largely irrelevant. I don't know how many will survive because most of them will not be able to pay the bills because offerings and whatnot have gone down, of course, etc. So there's that financial aspect that has completely been undermined and destroyed of physically running a building, paying for the heat or whatnot, you know? So that has basically been undermined. I don't know how many will come out. I think not many. And I think those that do come out will have had some serious, serious questions to answer. Secondly, I think as in China, there will be those churches that are allowed and those that are unallowed or not allowed. You have a legitimate state church and you will have a non-state church, i.e. one that is, approved by the committee of the whatever ruling power, and one that is not going to be approved. And so I think that is going to be the next, after COVID, I think that is going to be the next assault, for lack of a better term, on the body of the church. It's going to come to down to deciding, they've already done it through the tax exemption and all that sort of thing. I mean, they know what to do. It's easy to do. Because all you have to do to make people behave is to say, okay, I'll yank your tax exemption, and suddenly everyone falls into place. So the system knows how to manage these churches. But I think the next one is going to be legitimate and the illegitimate, i.e. the state-sanctioned and the non-sanctioned. And that is going to, of course, undermine whatever is left after COVID. We're not out of COVID yet, so it's going to be a while. So that, I think, is the next persecution, if we want to call it that. That is what's coming next, i.e. state-approved churches, state-approved faith, state-approved belief systems, and those that are not. And that's going to be the next challenge. And I don't think the church is up to it as they are right now to handle it institutionally, I should say, institutionally. So this is what I'm seeing on the horizon personally.
Yes, indeed. And you can see that narrative in a broader sense politically in many ways, but certainly like a lot came to a head in these United States in late December, early January, and after a certain hootenanny in and on the Capitol. And you can see right after that, the media and they've been massaging this gently, but they really gave us a deep tissue massage in January, where you can see that now that over the past 200 years, the agenda has gotten everyone to operate through legal structures and to think like that. And indeed, I would argue the disassociation of the body that you mentioned with the transgender issue, going back to the homosexual issue, I would actually, maybe this is just my own bailiwick speaking, my own little hobby horse of an interest, I would say that goes back to the acceptance of Western societies for the legal person. Yeah. Where in society, we've been led to believe that there is this other entity that can be administered to, and that is us. So it creates this psychopathy or this dissonance that in other ways in later 20th century history manifests itself physically. Something maybe we can chat later, was certainly food for thought. Howsomever, now that we do accept these categories, even 78 billion categories for the gender or legal categories of all sorts, what you can see now is those who are not hacking the agenda, broadly speaking, after the Capitol events have very explicitly been put onto, oh, you are a mental health problem. You need to be helped, right? This sort of thing, this will marry with the credit score. By the way, people, the credit score is not just in China. It's already been here for a couple of years. You've already accepted financial credit scores, right? Right now, for the past 10 years, they made that up. You took that hook, line, and sinker. Man, we love that credit score. What's your number, Dr. Doss? What's your number, John Coleman, right? We took the Social Security. But already, this social credit score has been running here, not from the state, But like this new order, predictably from this new order, this social credit score has already been done by the corporations, right? They, you already go on websites, they've already compiled all your social media, all your tax stuff, all your this, that, and the other, and they give you a number, and when you want to get hired, they'll run that. They've already been running that for years, and that's where it's coming. That's proof of the order that's rising. It's not coming from the states. There we go. Any closing thoughts, Dr. Das, or any breadcrumbs for our next conversation where we want to take things?
Sure. I would suggest that as followers of Christ, we do not lose hope and we remain charitable. I think this is the key here. All too often, we look at the world and see the situation as hopeless. I don't think it's hopeless. Yes, it's going to be miserable. Yes, it's going to be dark. I agree. But I think Christ is triumphant. That's, you know, this is my response to all of this stuff all the time. Yes, but Christ is risen. I think this is the key here. Yes, it's dark. Yes, it's going to get worse. And yes, it may be miserable for a lot of us for a long time. But this, again, is taking us back to the beginning of our conversation. What is life all about? And this is what goes back to the beginning of our conversation with that, you know, passage in Romans that we looked at. Are we going to be worried about, you know, the body all the time? Or are we also going to cultivate the soul? And so dark as it is, but I think also I see, you know, light. And what I see the light as is very simply, I think people are going to become very, very spiritual in the real sense of the word. I don't mean yoga and all this sort of thing, but our people are going to become more in tune with the hunger that is now possessing our souls. We don't feed the souls at all. We only feed the body. And I think this persecution, this coming hardship is going to force us to start feeding the soul. And we will understand what kind of food it needs. Because we no longer know how to feed it, hence the confusion. So I think, yes, it's dark. Yes, it's all that. But I also see great light at the end, at the end of the dark tunnel.
And as we approach that topic in our next episodes, I think where I want to bring this is much like Dr. Das has, very much I see a return to basics there. It's going to be very heady because, as where I'm coming from, it could be very easy to, I suppose, everything to kind of be subsumed into a type of milieu we associate with maybe evangelicalism or something like where there's a certain chaos or whatnot. So how do the authentic historical aspects of Christianity, including a structure, including authority, sacraments, and so forth, how are they maintained without slipping into a type of chaos or a dissolution, which you know, really, if you go back to, you know, 5th, 6th, 7th centuries, I think you had a kind of a Christian world which kind of looked a lot like this. It took a long time to foment this one church. And part of that getting back to basics is even amongst the devout, realizing that certain historical narratives, which we felt very assured in, a type of very corporate understanding of the church, which we've been telling ourselves about, never really existed until the 19th century. And that's something I'd like to talk about. But to avoid the dangers in this new ecclesiology, which is going to assert itself, this order is done. But I mean, everyone's just waiting to retire, all these bishops and things. This thing's done. And just turn off the lights, put a fork in it. So to avoid the landmines, the dangers ahead as we see this new dawn arising. All right, Dr. Das, what can we look forward to in the Postol this month?
Yes, coming up, we have some very interesting articles. One that I'm written by a very interesting scholar in France, and she is going to be looking at how Buddhism has been basically fabricated in the 19th century. It's a very fascinating account, a very fascinating analysis, and I think people will find it very interesting, because a lot of what we think are supposedly ancient religions aren't so ancient.
Excellent, excellent. Yes, and very appropriate to our topic of late, isn't it? A lot of these ancient Catholic things are about 100 years old.
Exactly.
including the smoke from St. Peter's, you know, that stuff, they started in the 1920s. You think like some ancient custom or something. Anyway, for Abacus de Stacy's, which is the college that Dr. Das and I run, we have a physical plant here in Holy, Connecticut, and then a lot of online work as well. And if you're interested in our very intensive 2 and 3 week summer sessions, or if a more traditional 16 week semester, you know, your traditional college semester, in either case, please go to abacusdestacysinstitute.wordpress.com and you will see the entire spread of our courses. We're going to offer the same stuff for the summer and for the autumn, just the intensity will be different, but the same material. At the same time, ultimately, just dragged out or condensed. And check out our YouTube channel and our BitChute and our Facebook and all of that. You can go on the web WordPress and see the links over there. If you have any correspondence about this series, Christian History and Ideas, please write us at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com. All of those links will be in the description below. Dr. Das and I have to head off to our yoga class or whatever. So we're going to sign off here. Thank you so much, Dr. Das.
Thank you so much.